Growing up and seeing your parents' flaws is like losing your religion. I don't believe in God anymore. I don't believe in my father either. My mother kissed her teeth when he gave her the ticket. She might as well have slapped him. "You and your foolishness," she said, and stood up. "You can't keep your ticket. I'm not going anywhere." She walked out of the kitchen. We listened as she walked the 20 steps to the bathroom and slammed the door with all her might. None of us knew what to say. Peter slumped in his chair and hung his head so you couldn't find his face under his dreadlocks. I just looked at the space where she'd been. My father's eyes disappeared behind his dreaming veil. In his typical denial of reality way, he said,
"Don't worry about your mother. She don't mean it, man."
But she did mean it. She didn't go with us. Even Peter couldn't convince her. She said the ticket price was a waste of her hard-earned money. On the night of the show, Peter and I took the subway alone to the theater. My father had gone ahead to get ready. We sat in the first row and didn't mention the empty seat next to us. I want to be able to say now that he was not good, that his talents were only mediocre. Mediocre would explain all the years of rejection. It would explain why he gave up and retreated from real life and into his head. And I don't know if I can see my father clearly. Maybe I'm still seeing with my old hero worship eyes. But what I saw was this. He was excellent. He was transcendent. He belonged on that stage more than he's ever belonged with us.
Area teen pretty sure day can't get worse is wrong about that. My dad's with the customer when I walk in. His eyes tell me that he will have many things to say to me later. I might as well give us some more to talk about. It's just after the lunch rush, so the store's pretty empty. There's only one other customer, a woman looking at blow dryers. I don't see Charlie cleaning or restocking any of the shelves, so I figure he must be slacking off in the stockroom in the back. I'm not even nervous. I don't give a shit if he beats my face in, so long as I say what I have to say first. I drop my jacket outside the stockroom door and turn the handle, but it's locked. There's no reason for it to be locked with him in it. He's probably jacking off in there. He pulls the door open before I can pound on it. Instead of his usual sneer, his face is a combination of tired and defensive. He must have thought it was my dad trying to get in. As soon as he sees it's just me, his face goes into full superior asshole smirk. He makes a show of looking over my shoulder and around me. "Where's your girlfriend?" He says girlfriend like it's a joke, the way you would say a word like booger. I stand there looking at him, trying to figure out not how we're related, but why. He pushes past me, deliberately bumping into my shoulder. "She dump you already?" he asks, after taking a quick look down a couple of aisles to verify that she's really not here. His shit-eating grin is firmly in place. He's baiting me. I know. I know it. And still, I'm letting the hook pierce me like some dumb fish that's been hooked a billion times before and still hasn't figured it out yet that hooks are the enemy. "Fuck you, Charlie," I say. That catches him off guard. He stops smiling and takes a good look at me. My tie and jacket are missing. My shirt's untucked. I don't look like someone who has the most important interview of his life in a couple of hours. I look like someone who wants to get into a fight. He puffs himself up like a blowfish. He's always been so proud of the 2 years and 2 inches that he has on me. It's just him and me back here, and that makes him bold. "Why are you here, little brother?" he asks. He steps closer, so that we're toe-to-toe, and pushes his face closer to mine. He expects me to back down. I don't back down. I came to ask you a question. He pulls his face back just a little. Sure, I'd fuck her, he says. Is that what happened? She want me instead of you? The thing about being a fish on a hook is the more you try to get off, the more trapped you are. The hook just buries itself deeper and you bleed a little more. You can't get off the hook. You can only go through it. Said another way, the hook has to go through you. And it's gonna hurt like a motherfucker. Why are you like this? I ask him. If I've surprised him, he doesn't show it. He just goes on with his usual shittiness.
Like what? Bigger, stronger, smarter, better?
No, why are you an asshole to me? What did I do to you? This time he can't hide his surprise. He pulls out of my space, even takes a step back.
Whatever. That what you came here for? To whine about me being mean to you?
He looks me up and down again.
You look like shit. Don't you have to try to get into second best school today?
I don't care about that. I don't even want to go. I say it quietly, but it still feels good to say it at all.
Speak up, little brother. I didn't hear you.
I don't want to go, I say louder, before realizing that my dad left his position at the register and is now close enough to hear me. He starts to say something, but then the doorbell chimes. He pivots away. I turn back to Charlie. I've been trying to figure it out for years. Maybe I did something to you when we were younger and I don't remember. He snorts.
What could you do to me? You're too pathetic.
So you're just an asshole? I ask. Just the way you're made?
I'm stronger and smarter and better than you.
If you're so smart, what are you doing back here, Charlie? Is it big fish, small pond syndrome? Were you just a tiny douchebag fish at Harvard?
He clenches his fists. Watch your mouth.
My guess is good. More than good, even. I'm right, aren't I? You're not the best there. Turns out you're not the best here either. How does it feel to be second best son?
I'm the one with the hook now. His face is red and he's puffing himself back up. He gets right in my face. If he clenches his jaw any more, it will break.
You want to know why I don't like you?
Because you're just like them.
He points his chin in the direction of our dad.
You and your Korean food and your Korean friends and studying Korean in school, it's pathetic. Don't you get it, little brother? You're just like everybody else.
Wait, what?
You hate me because I have Korean friends?
Korean is all you are, he spits out.
We're not even from the goddamn country.
And I get it. I really do. Some days it's hard to be in America. Some days I feel like I'm halfway to the moon, trapped between the earth and it. The fight leaves me. I'm just sorry for him now, and that's exactly the worst thing I can do to him. He sees the pity on my face. It enrages him. He grabs me by the collar.
Fuck you. You think because you grew your hair out and you like poetry, anybody's gonna treat you any different? You think because you bring some black girl in here, or should I call her African American, or maybe just...
But I don't let him get the word out. I thought I would have to work myself up to it, but I don't have to. I punch him right in the fucking face. My fist catches him around the eye socket area, so my knuckles hit mostly bone. It hurts me more than it has any right to, given that I'm the one supposedly delivering this beatdown. He stumbles back but doesn't fall flat like people do in the movies. This is, frankly, disappointing. Still, the look on his face is worth all the I'm sure there are broken bones in my hand. I definitely hurt him. What I mean is, I caused him physical pain, as was my intention. I wanted him to know that I, his little brother, could dish it out and not just take it. Now he knows I can hurt him, and that I'm done putting up with his crap. I don't do enough damage, though. I watch his expression turn from pain to surprise to rage. He comes at me with his extra 2 inches and his extra 20 pounds of muscle. First, he punches me in the stomach. I swear it's like his fist goes through my stomach and out through my spinal cord. I double over and think that maybe I'll just stay in this position, but he's not having it. He pulls me up by my collar. I try to block my face with my hands because I know that's where he's going, but the stomach punch makes me slow. His fist smashes into the side of my mouth. My lip splits open on the inside from bashing into my teeth. It splits open on the outside because the bastard hit me while wearing some giant-ass secret society ring. That's gonna leave a mark, possibly forever. He's still got my collar in his fist, ready to deliver another blow, but I'm ready for him. I block my face with my hands and bring my knee right up into his balls. Hard, but not hard enough to prevent him from having future little demon spawn children. I'm nice like that. He's down on the ground, clutching the family jewels that he wishes were not Korean, and I'm holding my jaw, trying to figure out if I still have all my teeth, when my dad comes over to us.
무슨 일이야?
He says, which loosely translates to, what's going on here?
Attorney Fitzgerald's fingers are steepled, and his eyes are fixed on mine. He leans forward in his chair slightly. I can't decide if he's listening or if he just wants to look like he's listening. How many stories like mine has he heard over the years? I'm amazed that he's not telling me to get to the point. I finish telling him everything about the night in question. The actors took 3 bows. They would have taken a 4th if the audience members hadn't started filing out. Afterward, Peter and I stayed in our seats, waiting for our father to come back out to get us. We waited for 30 minutes before he showed up. I don't think it was because he knew we were waiting. He appeared through the thick red curtains and walked to the center of the stage. He stood there for a full minute, just staring out into the now empty theater. I don't believe in souls, but his soul was on his face. I've never seen him happier. I'm certain he will never be that happy again. Peter broke the spell because I couldn't bring myself to do it. You ready, Pops? He shouted. My father looked down at us with his faraway eyes. When he looks at us like that, I'm not sure if it's him who's missing or us. Peter got uncomfortable, the way he always does when my father does that. Pops, you ready, man? When my father finally spoke, he had no trace of a Jamaican accent and no Jamaican diction at all. He sounded like a stranger. You children go on ahead. I will see you later. I speed through the rest of the story. My father spends the rest of that evening drinking with his new actor friends. He drinks too much. On his way home, he rams his car into a parked police car. In his drunkenness, he tells the police officer the whole history of our coming to America. I imagine he monologued for this audience of one. He tells the policeman we're undocumented immigrants and that America never gave him a fair shot. The officer arrests him and calls Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Attorney Fitzgerald's brows are furrowed. But why would your father do that? He asks. It's a question I know the answer to.
Samuel Kingsley, A Father's History. Characters: Patricia Kingsley, 43. Samuel Kingsley, 45. Act 2, Scene 3. Interior bedroom. A single queen-sized bed with headboard dominates the space, perhaps a picture frame or two. The floor on Samuel's side of the bed is overflowing with books. Stage right we see an opening to a hallway. Samuel and Patricia's teenage daughter is listening, but neither Samuel nor Patricia knows it. It's not clear that they would care if they did. Patricia. Lord have mercy, Kingsley. She is seated on the edge of her bed. Her face is in her hands. Her speech is muffled. Samuel.
It don't mean nothing, man. We going to get a good lawyer.
Samuel Kingsley is standing on his side of the room. He is hunched, with his face in shadow. A spotlight shines brightly on the single sheet of paper he holds in his left hand. Patricia.
And how we go pay for a lawyer, Kingsley?
Samuel.
Lord, Patsy. We figure it out, man.
Patricia takes her face out of her hands and looks at her husband, as if she's seeing him for the first time. Patricia.
You remember the day we did meet?
Samuel slowly crumples the paper in his hand. He continues to do this throughout the scene. Patricia.
You don't remember, Kingsley? How you came into the store and then you kept coming back day after day. That was so funny. One day you buy something, and the next day you return it until you wear me down.
Samuel.
Wasn't no wearing down, Patsy. It was courting.
Patricia.
You remember all the promises you make me, Kingsley?
Samuel.
Patsy.
Patricia.
You say all me dreams would come true. We going have children and money and big house. You say me happiness more important than your own. You remember that, Kingsley?
She rises from the bed and the spotlight follows her as she moves. Samuel.
Patsy.
Patricia.
Let me tell you something. I didn't believe you when we started out. But after a time, I changed my mind. You a good actor, Kingsley. Because you make me believe all the pretty things you say to me.
The paper in Samuel's hand is fully crumpled now. The spotlight moves to his face and he's no longer hunched. He is angry.
Samuel. You know what me tired of hearing about. Me tired of your dreams. What about mine? If it wasn't for you and children then, I would have all the things I want. You complain about house and kitchen and extra bedroom. But what about me? I don't have any of the thing them that I want. I don't get to use my God-given talent. I rule the day I walk into that store. If it wasn't for you and the children, my life would be better. I will be doing the thing God put me on this earth to do. I don't want to hear nothing more about your dreams. Them not nothing compared to mine.
But I don't tell Attorney Fitzgerald that part, about how my father's wife and children are his greatest regret, because we got in the way of the life he dreamed for himself. Instead, I say, a few weeks after he was arrested, we got the notice to appear letter from Homeland Security. He looks over one of the forms I filled out earlier for the paralegal and gets a yellow legal pad out of his desk drawer.
So then you went to the master calendar hearing? Did you bring a lawyer with you?
Only my parents went, I tell him, and they didn't bring a lawyer. My mom and I talked about it a lot before the appointment. Should we hire a lawyer we couldn't really afford, or wait to see what happened at the hearing? We'd read online that you didn't really need a lawyer for the first appointment. At that point, my father was still insisting that everything would miraculously work itself out. I don't know. Maybe we wanted to believe that was true. Attorney Fitzgerald shakes his head and jots something down on his legal pad.
So at the hearing, the judge tells them they can accept voluntary removal or file for cancellation of removal.
He looks down at my forms.
Your younger brother is a U.S. citizen?
Yes, I say, watching as he notes that down too. Peter was born almost exactly 9 months after we moved here. My parents were still happy with each other then. My father didn't accept the voluntary removal at that hearing. That night, my mom and I researched cancellation of removal. In order to qualify, my dad needed to have lived in the United States for at least 10 years, have shown good moral character, and be able to prove that being deported would cause an extreme hardship on a spouse, parent, or child who was a U.S. citizen. We thought Peter's citizenship was going to be our saving grace. We hired the cheapest lawyer we could find and went to the merits hearing armed with this new strategy. But as it turns out, it's very difficult to prove extreme hardship. Going back to Jamaica will not put Peter's life in danger. And no one cares about the psychological danger of uprooting a child from his home, not even Peter himself.
And at the merits hearing, the judge denies your case and your father accepts the voluntary removal.
Attorney Fitzgerald says it flatly, like the outcome was inevitable. I nod instead of answering out loud. I'm not sure I'll be able to talk without crying. Any hope I had is slipping away. I'd argued that we should appeal the judge's decision, but our lawyer advised against it. She said we had no case and that we were out of options. She suggested we leave voluntarily so we wouldn't have a deportation on our records. That way we'd have a hope of returning one day. Fitzgerald puts his pen down and leans back in his chair.
Why did you go to USCIS today? It's not even their jurisdiction.
I have to clear the tears pooling in my throat before I can answer. I didn't know what else to do. The truth is, despite the fact that I don't believe in miracles, I was hoping for one. He's silent for a long time. Finally, I can't take any more. It's okay, I say. I know I'm out of options. I don't even know why I came here. I make a move to get up, but he waves me back down. He steeples his fingers again and looks around the office. I follow his eyes to the unpacked boxes lining the wall just to his right. Behind him, a folding ladder rests against an empty bookshelf.
We're just moving in, he says. The construction guys were supposed to be done weeks ago, but you know what they say about plans.
He smiles and touches the bandage on his forehead. Are you okay, Mr. Fitz?
I'm fine, he says,
rubbing at the bandage. He picks up a framed picture from his desk and looks at it.
This is the only thing I've unpacked so far.
He turns the picture so I can see it. It's him with his wife and 2 children. They seem happy. I smile politely. He puts it back down and looks at me.
You're never out of options, Ms. Kingsley.
It takes me a second to realize that he's back to talking about my case. I lean forward in my seat. Are you saying you can fix this?
I'm one of the best immigration lawyers in this city, he says.
But how? I ask. I lay my hands on his desk, press my fingers against the wood.
Let me go see a judge friend of mine. He'll be able to get the voluntary removal reversed, so at least you don't have to leave tonight. After that, we can file an appeal with the BIA, the Board of Immigration Appeals.
He checks his watch.
Just give me a couple of hours.
I open my mouth to ask for more facts and specifics. I find them reassuring. The poem comes back to me. Hope is the thing with feathers. I close my mouth. For the second time today, I'm letting go of the details. Maybe I don't need them. It would be so nice to let someone else take over this burden for a little while. Hope is the thing with feathers. I feel it fluttering in my heart.
My dad looks at me from head to toe, and I feel like the second-rate slacker he's always taken me for. I will always be second son to him, no matter what Charlie does. I must look even worse than when I first came in. The top button of my shirt is missing from where Charlie grabbed me. There's even a bloodstain on it from my busted lip. I'm sweaty, and my hair is sticking to the side of my face. Premium Yale material right here. He gives me an order. Get some ice for your leap and come back out here. Charlie's next. You hit your little brother? That what you learn from America, to hit your family? I almost want to stay and hear where this goes, but my fat lip is getting fatter. I go into the back room and grab a can of Coke and press it against my lip. I've never liked this room. It's too small and always clogged with half-open boxes of product. There are no chairs, so I sit on the floor with my back against the door so no one can get in. I need 5 minutes before dealing with my life again. My lip throbs in time to my heartbeat. I wonder if I need stitches. I press the can closer and wait to feel, or not feel, the numbness. This is what I get for letting the fates guide me. Beat up, girlfriendless, futureless. Why did I postpone my interview? Worse, why did I let Natasha walk away? Maybe she was right. I'm just looking for someone to save me. I'm looking for someone to take me off the track my life is on, because I don't know how to do it myself. I'm looking to get overwhelmed by love and meant to be and destiny, so that the decisions about my future will be out of my hands. It won't be me defying my parents. It will be fate. The Coke can does the trick. I can't feel my lip anymore. Good thing Natasha's not here, because my kissing days are over, at least for today. And with her, there's no tomorrow. Not that she'd ever let me kiss her again. From the other side of the door, my dad orders me to come out. I put the can back in the fridge and tuck my shirt in. I open the door to find him standing there alone. He leans in close to me. "I have a question for you," he says. "Why do you think it matters what you want?" The way he asks, it's like he's genuinely confused by the emotion. What is this desire and wanting that you speak of? He's confused by why they matter at all. "Who cares what you want? The only thing that matters is what is good for you. Your mother and I only care about what is good for you. You to go school, you become a doctor, you be successful. Then you never have to work in a store like this. Then you have money and respect, and all the things you want will come. You find a nice girl and have children and you have the American dream. Why would you throw your future away for temporary things that you only want right now?" It's the most my father has ever said to me at once. He's not even angry as he says it. He talks like he's trying to teach me something basic. 1 + 1 = 2, son. Ever since he bought the oil paints for Umma, I've wanted to have a conversation like this with him. I've wanted to know why he wants the things he wants for us. Why it's so important to him. I want to ask him if he thinks Umma's life would have been better if she'd kept painting. I want to know if he's sad that she gave it up for him and for us. Maybe this moment right now between my dad and me is the meaning of today. Maybe I can begin to understand him. Maybe he can begin to understand me. "Appa," I begin. But he holds his hand up to silence me and keeps it there. The air around us is still and metallic. He looks at me and through me and past me to some other time. "No," he says. "You let me finish. Maybe I make it too easy for you boys. Maybe this is my fault. You don't know your history. You don't know what poor can do. I don't tell you because I think things are better that way. Better not to know. Maybe I am wrong. I'm so close. I'm at the edge of knowing him. We're at the edge of knowing each other. I'm going to tell him that I don't want the things for myself that he wants for me. I'm going to tell him that I'll be okay anyway. Appa, I begin again, but again his hand goes through the air. Again I am silenced. He knows what I'm going to say, and he doesn't want to hear it. My father is shaped by the memory of things I will never know.
Enough! You don't go to Yale and become a doctor? Then you find a job and pay for college yourself.
He walks back to the front of the store. I'll admit that there's something refreshing about having it all laid out for me like this, future or no future. My suit jacket is still crumpled by the door. I grab it and put it on. The lapel almost covers the bloodstain. I look around for Charlie, but he's nowhere to be found. I walk to the door. My dad's behind the cash register, staring off at nothing. I'm about to leave when he says the final thing, the thing he's been waiting to say.
I saw the way you looked at that girl, he says, but that can never be.
I think you're wrong, I tell him.
Doesn't matter what you think. You do the right thing.
We make and hold eye contact. It's the holding of eye contact that tells me he's not sure what I'm going to do. Neither am I.
Dae-hyun Bae, A Dad's History. Dae-hyun Bae opens and closes the cash register. Opens and closes it again. Maybe it really is his fault that his sons are the way they are. He's told them nothing about his past. He does it because he's a father who loves his sons fiercely, and it's his way of protecting them. He thinks of poverty as a kind of contagion, and he doesn't want them to hear about it, lest they catch it. He opens the register and packs the large bills into the deposit pouch. Charlie and Daniel think money and happiness are not related. They don't know what poor is. They don't know that poverty is a sharp knife carving away at you. They don't know what it does to a body, to a mind. When Dae-hyun was 13 and still living in South Korea, his father began grooming him to take over the family's meager crab fishing business. The business barely made any money. Every season was a fight for survival, and every season they survived, but just barely. For most of his childhood, there was never any doubt in Dae-hyun's mind that he would eventually take over the business. He was the eldest of three sons. It was his place. Family is destiny. He can still remember the day that sparked a small rebellion in his mind. For the first time, his father had taken him out on the fishing boat. Dae-hyun hated it. Trapped in the cold mesh metal baskets, the crabs formed a furious, writhing column of desperation. They scrabbled and clawed their way over each other, trying to get to the top and to escape. Even now, the memory of that first day still crops up at unexpected times. Dae-hyun wishes he could forget it. He'd imagined that coming to America would wipe it clean. But the memory always comes back. Those crabs never gave up. They fought until they died. They would have done anything to escape.
It's hard to know how to feel now. I don't really trust what's happened, or maybe I just haven't had enough time to process it. I check my phone. Bev's finally texted. She loves, loves, loves Berkeley. She says she thinks she's destined to go there. Also, California boys are cute in a different way from New York boys. The last text asks how I am, with a string of broken heart emojis. I decide to call and tell her what Attorney Fitzgerald said, but she doesn't pick up. Call me, I text. I push my way through the revolving doors and out into the courtyard, and then I just stop moving. A handful of people are having lunch on the benches next to the fountain. Separate groups of fast walkers in suits go in and out of the building. A line of black town cars idles at the curb while their drivers smoke and chat with each other. How can this be the same day? How can all these people be going about their lives, totally oblivious to what's been happening to mine? Sometimes your world shakes so hard, it's difficult to imagine that everyone else isn't feeling it too. That's how I felt when we first got the deportation notice. It's also how I felt when I figured out that Rob was cheating on me. I take out my phone again and look up Rob's number before remembering I deleted it. My brain holds on to numbers, though, and I dial his from memory. I don't realize why I'm calling until I'm actually on the phone with him.
"Hey, Nat," he drawls.
He doesn't even have the grace to sound surprised. "My name's not Nat," I say. Now that I have him on the phone, I'm not sure I want him on the phone.
"Not cool what you and your new dude did today."
His voice is deep and slow and lazy, like it's always been. Funny how things that once seemed so charming can become dull and annoying. We think we want all the time in the world with the people we love, but maybe what we need is the opposite, just a finite amount of time, so we still think the other person is interesting. Maybe we don't need acts 2 and 3. Maybe love is best in act 1. I ignore his scolding and the urge to point out that he was the one shoplifting, and therefore he was the uncool one. "I have a question," I say.
"Go for it,"
he says. "Why did you cheat on me?" Something falls to the floor on his end, and he stammers the beginning of 3 different answers. "Calm down," I say. "I'm not calling to fight with you, and I definitely don't want to get back together. I just want to know. Why didn't you just break up with me? Why cheat?"
"I don't know,"
he says, managing to stumble over 3 simple words. "Come on," I urge. "There's gotta be a reason." He's quiet, thinking.
"I really don't know."
I stay silent.
"You're great," he says. "And Kelly's great. I didn't want to hurt your feelings, and I didn't want to hurt her feelings."
He sounds sincere, and I don't know what to do with that. "But you must have liked her better to cheat, right?"
"No. I just wanted both of you."
"That's it?" I ask. "You didn't want to choose?"
"That's it,"
he says, as if that's enough. This answer is so wholly lame, so unbelievably unsatisfying that I almost hang up. Daniel would never feel this way. His heart chooses. "One more question. Do you believe in true love and all that stuff?"
"No, you know me better than that. You don't believe in it either,"
he reminds me. "Don't I? Okay, thanks." I'm about to hang up, but he stops me.
"Can I at least tell you that I'm sorry?"
he asks. "Go ahead."
"I'm sorry."
"Okay," I say. "Don't cheat on Kelly."
"I won't," he says.
I think he means it while he's saying it. I should call my parents and tell them about Attorney Fitzgerald, but they're not who I want to tell right now. Daniel. I need to find him and tell him. Rob says I don't believe in true love, and he's right, I don't. But I might want to.
I leave the store. A violinist is standing on a milk crate in front of the pawn shop right next door. She's pale and scrawny and bedraggled in a poetic sort of way, like something out of David Copperfield. Unlike her, the violin is pristine. I listen for a few seconds, but don't know if she's any good. I know there's an objective way to judge these things. Is she playing all the right notes in the right order and in tune? But there's another way to judge, too. Does this music being played right here, right now, matter to someone? I decide it matters to me. I jog back to where she is and drop a dollar into her hat. There's a sign next to the hat that I don't read. I don't really want to know her story. I just want the music and the moment. My dad said Natasha and I can never work out. And maybe he's right. But not for the reasons he thinks. What an idiot I've been. I should be with her right now. Even if today is all we have. Especially if today is all we have. We live in the age of the cell phone, but I do not have her cell phone number. I don't even know her last name. Like an idiot, I Google Natasha Facebook New York City, and I get 5,780,000 hits. I click through maybe 100 links, and while the Natashas are all quite lovely, none of them is my Natasha. Who knew that her name was so flipping popular? It's 4:15 p.m., and the streets are starting to fill up again with evening commuters heading for the subways. Like me, they look worse for wear. I jog on the curb to prevent pedestrians on the sidewalk from slowing me down. I don't have a plan except to find her again. The only thing to do is go to her last known location, the lawyer's office on 52nd, and hope that fate is on my side, and she's still there.
A couple, both with bright blue mohawks, is arguing in front of the 52nd Street subway entrance. They're doing that weird whisper-hiss thing that couples do when they fight in public. I can't hear what they're saying, but their gestures say it all. She's outraged at him. He's exasperated with her. They're definitely not at the beginning of their relationship. They both look too weary for that. You can see their long history just in the way they lean toward each other. Is this the last fight they'll ever have? Is this the one that ends it all? I look back at them after I pass. Once upon a time, I'm sure they were in love. Maybe they still are, but you can't tell from looking.
I descend into the subway and say a prayer to the subway gods. Yes, multiple gods. That the train ride will be free of electrical issues and religiously challenged conductors. What if I'm too late? What if she's already gone? What if stopping to give a dollar to that violinist started a chain of events that causes me to miss her? We pull into the station. Directly across the platform, the downtown train pulls in at the same time. Our doors close, but the train doesn't move. On the platform, a group of about 20 people in brightly colored, skin-tight bodysuits materializes. They look like tropical birds against the dark gray of the subway. They line up, and then freeze in place, waiting for something to set them off. It's a flash mob. The train across the platform doesn't move either. One of the dancers, a guy in electric blue with an enormous package, presses play on a boombox. At first, it just seems like chaos. Each person dancing to their own tune, but then I realize they're just offset by a few seconds. It's like singing in a round, except they're dancing. They start out with ballet and move on to disco and then breakdancing before the subway cops catch on. The dancers scatter and my fellow passengers applaud wildly. We pull away, but now the atmosphere in the train is completely changed. People are smiling at each other and saying how cool that was. It's at least 30 seconds before everyone puts back on his or her protective, "I'm on a train filled with strangers" face. I wonder if that was the dancer's intention, to get us all to connect, just for a moment.
I'm sitting with my back to the platform, so I don't really see how it starts. The only way I know something unusual is happening is that the entire train car seems to be looking at something behind me. I turn around and find that there's a flash mob dancing on the platform. They're all wearing very bright clothing and disco dancing. Only in New York City, I think, and take out my phone to snap a few pictures. My fellow passengers cheer and clap. One guy even starts doing his own moves. The dance doesn't last long because three subway cops break it up. A few boos go up before everyone resumes being impatient about the train not moving. Normally, I would have wondered what the point of those people was. Don't they have jobs or something better to do? If Daniel were here, he'd say that maybe this is the thing they are supposed to be doing. Maybe the whole point of the dancers is just to bring a little wonder into our lives. And isn't that just as valid a purpose as any?
I dart out of the 52nd Street subway and almost run into a couple making out like nobody's business. Even without the blue hair, they'd be hard to miss because they're basically fused together from head to toe. They need a room, and stat. Seriously, it's like they're having an emergency makeout session right here on the sidewalk. They've each got the other's ass firmly in hand. Mutual ass grabbage. A pinched-faced man makes a disapproving clucking sound as he walks by. A little boy gawks at them with a wide-open mouth. His dad covers his eyes. Watching them makes me unreasonably happy. I guess the cliche is true. People in love want everyone else to be in love. I hope their relationship lasts forever.
I make the right onto MLK Boulevard and walk toward Daniel's store. At the shop next door to his, a girl is standing on a milk crate playing violin. She's white, with long black hair that hasn't been washed in a long time. Her face is too thin, not fashionable thin, but hungry thin. She's such a sad, strange sight that I have to stop. The sign next to her tip hat reads, "Please help. Need $$$$ to buy violin back from loan shark." A thick black arrow on the sign points to the pawn shop. I can't imagine how life led her to this place, but I take out a dollar and throw it into her hat, bringing her total to $2. The door to the pawn shop opens and an enormous white guy in a white tracksuit comes out and over to us. He is all jowls and scowls. "Time's up," he says, holding out his giant hand to her. She stops playing immediately and hops down from the crate. She gathers the money from the hat and gives it to him. She even gives him the hat. Tracksuit pockets the money and puts the hat on his head. "How much is left?" she asks. He takes a small notebook and pencil out of his pocket and writes something down.
$1.51.23.
He snaps his fingers at her for the violin. She hugs the violin to her chest before relinquishing it. "I'll be back tomorrow. You promise not to sell it?" she asks. He grunts an assent.
"You show up, I don't sell it," he concedes.
"I promise to be here," she says.
"Promises don't mean shit," he says and walks away.
She looks at the storefront for a long time. I can't tell from her face whether she agrees with him.
Even if Natasha were still here, I wouldn't know where to go in the glass monstrosity of a building. I stare at the directory, trying to divine her location. I know she went to see a lawyer, but the directory is not very specific. For instance, it doesn't say, "Attorney so-and-so, immigration lawyer to 17-year-old Jamaican girls named Natasha." I ransack my mind and come up with nothing. I take out my phone to check the time. Just over an hour until my date with Destiny. It occurs to me that I should check the new address the receptionist gave me earlier. If it's too far away, I'll have the perfect excuse to ditch it. According to Google Maps, though, I'm already there. Either Google is having an existential crisis, or I am. I look at the address again and then back up at the directory. No shit. My interview is in this building. I am already where I'm supposed to be.
I push the door open, and the bell chimes with happy optimism. I am not that optimistic about my chances here, but I have to try. I expect to see Daniel's dad behind the counter, but Charlie's there instead. He's typing something on his phone and barely glances up. I wonder who I'd have more luck with, Charlie or his dad. I don't have a choice, though, because his dad is nowhere in sight. I walk up to the counter. "Hey," I say. He keeps typing away for a few seconds before banging the phone down on the counter. Probably not the best way to greet a potential customer.
"What can I help you with?"
he asks, when he finally looks up. I'm shocked to see that his eye socket is red and swollen. It will be bruised black and blue by morning. He raises his hand and touches his eye self-consciously. His knuckles are bruised, too. It takes him a second to recognize me.
"Wait, aren't you Daniel's little girlfriend?"
He must practice sneering in the mirror. He's excellent at it. "Yes," I say. He looks past me, searching for Daniel.
"Where is that little shit?"
"I'm not sure. I was hoping," I begin. He cuts me off and gives me a slow, wide smile. I think he's trying to be sexy. I can see how, if you didn't know him at all, it would work. But I do know him a little, and the smile makes me want to punch him in the other eye.
"Come back for the better, brother, I see."
He winks the bad eye and then flinches in pain. Observable fact. I don't believe in karma, but I might start. "Do you have his cell phone number?" I ask. He leans back in his chair and picks up his phone from the counter.
"You two get into a fight or something?"
As much as I don't want to tell him anything, I have to keep this cordial. "Something like that," I say. "Do you have it?" He flips his phone end over end.
"You got a Korean boy fetish or what?"
He's smirking, but his eyes are watching me steadily. At first, I think he's just goading me, but then I realize it's a serious question. He cares about the answer. I'm not sure if he even knows how much he cares. "Why does it have to be a fetish?" I ask. "Why can't I just like your brother?" He scoffs.
"Please, what's to like? Guys like him are a dime a dozen."
And then I realize what Charlie's problem with Daniel is. He hates that Daniel doesn't hate himself. For all his uncertainties, Daniel is still more comfortable in his skin than Charlie will ever be in his. I feel sorry for him, but I don't let it show. "Please help me."
"Tell me why I should."
He's not smiling or sneering or smirking at all anymore. He has all the power, and we both know it. I don't know him well enough to appeal to the good part of him. I'm not even sure if there is a good part of him. "Think how much trouble I'll cause for your brother," I say. "He's in love with me. He won't give me up no matter what your parents say or do. You can just sit back and enjoy the show." He throws his head back and laughs. "He really is not a good person. I mean, he might have some good parts. I think most people do. But Charlie's bad parts outweigh the good ones. I'm sure there are good reasons he is the way he is, but then I decide that the reasons don't matter. Some people exist in your life to make it better. Some people exist to make it worse. Still, though, he does a good thing for his brother. He gives me the number."
My phone rings, and I almost drop it like it's possessed. I don't recognize the number, but answer anyway. Hello? Is this Daniel? Natasha? I ask, even though I know it's her. Yes, it's me. Her voice smiles. Your brother gave me your number. Now I begin to suspect it's a practical joke by my asshole brother. No way would he ever do something so kind. Who is this? I demand. Daniel, it's me. It's really me. He gave you my number? Maybe he's not so bad after all, she says. Not a chance, I say back, and we both laugh. I found her. Well, she found me. I can't believe it. Where are you? I just left your store. Where are you? I'm at your lawyer's office building. What? Why? It's the only place I could think to find you. You've been looking for me? Her voice is shy. Will you forgive me for being such a jerk earlier? It's okay. I should have told you. It wasn't my business. Yes, it was, she says. It's not the three words I want to hear from her, but it's damn close.
He's sitting on one of the benches that face the fountain and writing in his notebook. I knew I'd be happy to see him, but I didn't expect to feel gleeful. I have to stop myself from jumping up and down and clapping my hands and maybe doing a twirl. Gleeful, which is not like me, so I don't do it. But the smile on my face needs to be measured in miles instead of inches. I slide onto the bench and bump his shoulder with mine. He pulls the notebook up to his face, covering his mouth, and then turns to face me. His eyes are wide and dancing. I don't think anyone's ever been as happy to see anyone as Daniel is to see me. Hey, he says from behind the notebook. I reach out to lower the book, but he shifts his body back from me. What's wrong? I ask. I might have gotten into a small fight, he says. You got into a small fight, and now I can't see your face? I just wanted to warn you first. I reach out again. This time he lets me lower the book. The right side of his lip is swollen and bruised. He looks like he's been in a boxing match. You fought with your brother, I say, making the connection. He had it coming. He keeps his face neutral, downplaying his feelings for my benefit. I didn't think poets fought. Are you kidding? We're the worst. He smiles at me, but then flinches in pain. I'm fine, he says, watching my face. It looks worse than it is. Why did you fight? I ask. It doesn't matter. Yes, it does. No, it doesn't. His lips are firm and straight. Whatever happened, he's not going to tell me. Was it about me? I ask, even though I know the answer. He nods. I decide to let it go. It's enough to know that he thinks I'm worth fighting for. I was pretty mad at you before, I say. I need to say it before we go any further. I know. I'm sorry. I just couldn't believe it. That I didn't tell you? I ask. No, that after all the things that had to happen to get us to meet today, something else was going to tear us apart. You really are hopeless. It's possible, he says. I rest my head on his shoulder and tell him about going to the museum and Anegito and all the things that had to go right for our solar system, galaxy, and universe to form. I tell him compared to that, falling in love just seems like small coincidences. He doesn't agree, and I'm glad for it. I reach out again and touch his lip. He captures my hand and turns his face into my palm and kisses the center. I've never really understood the phrase, they have chemistry, before now. After all, everything is chemistry. Everything is combination and reaction. The atoms in my body.